This is episode 65 of the Renew the Arts podcast, One Anothering in an Othering Age. Welcome to the Renew the Arts podcast, where we discuss the role of art and creativity in the church and the world. I am your host, Michael Minkoff. Our motto at Renew the Arts is liberate Christian creativity, and we're doing this through cultivating Christian communities in and through the arts by inspiring art patronage and supporting artists. If you'd like to join our community of monthly donors and contribute to this podcast, please visit renewthearts.org/donate. If you want to join the Porchlight Network and begin your journey into patronage, go to app.porchlight.org and sign up as a host or a tender. Well, welcome back for episode 65 of the Renew the Arts podcast. I'm here today with Chase Tremaine, musician, multi-instrumentalist, editor, and writer, and probably a lot of other things, dad. Yeah. You already know Chase's work if you've been listening to the podcast. Chase has actually been editing our podcast since last season, and he's very meticulous and so very easy to work with, and I've really appreciated working with him. During our in-person strategic planning meeting that we had at the end of last month for Renew the Arts, Chase was there, and he talked a good bit about the cultural moment we find ourselves in and how technology has centralized, virtualized, and depersonalized community and art making. And I was really enjoying what he had to say, which was somewhat cut short because of the format of our meeting. And so we decided I'd really like to hear more about it and that you also would be edified to hear about it too. So here we are. Welcome to this side of the podcast, Chase. It's great to have you.
It's great to be here. It's always fun to be a guest on a podcast since usually I'm either hosting it or editing it.
I wanted you to be able to basically pick up right where you left off during what you yourself called a rant. It didn't feel like a rant, but it was a monologue. How about that?
Yeah.
At the in-person gathering. Tell us a little bit about how you think technology has almost imperceptibly shifted our relationship to art and artists. And you talked about how it's happened so fast that we hardly even know that it's happened. And help us then to be a little bit more aware of what's been happening that perhaps we're not all that conscious of.
Yeah, so I think it's been argued that the 20th century had larger leaps than any other time in human history in terms of new inventions and new possibilities in a way that has so greatly disconnected our entire society from the norm and standards that existed for many thousands of years before us.
So tell us a little bit, what were the norms and standards for however many thousands of years?
Well, I mean, simply go pre-electricity, right? And you've changed just about everything. You know, even the fact that you and I are talking right now, like we're not sitting in a room together. We are speaking over the internet into microphones that are being recorded into a software where we can then go in and edit and morph and rearrange the words that we are speaking that, you know, prior to a few decades ago, that would have been impossible to do from within your own home, and go a century ago, and that's impossible, period. Mm-hmm. Even for the richest people, like that technology just didn't exist. So we are just a few generations deep into the existence of movies and recorded music and all these technologies that we now take for granted. And you and I have lived our entire lives where it's just been a given that movies exist, music exists. Our parents also grew up where that was already so entrenched in society that it's just a given. We're basically at the point now where no one is alive anymore that remembers movies being a new thing, where it wasn't just standard for houses to have radios, cars to have radios. And what's happened through this new normal that's been created is that music is now primarily considered something that we passively consume. And again, because we're a few generations in, we almost lack the cultural context to think of it as being something different. That the main way we ever experience music is the pre-recorded form that we just sit and listen to, whether it's in a car, in our home, you know, in the grocery store around us. And so it's the special occasion. It's the outside of the norm where we are experiencing music in its live, non-recorded form.
Which would have been the norm, is what you're saying.
Not just the norm, like the only possibility.
The only possibility.
Right.
Right. Would you say also there's a kind of a shift towards like individual consumption and not even communal consumption because of that?
Yes. So I think we are on a pendulum swing kind of so far from what was the baseline, like the only way to get music, right? For all of human existence before about 100 years ago was for you to sing or play an instrument, or for someone in the room with you to sing to you or play an instrument for you. That is all of music for all of human history until 100 years ago. And that has been like supplanted and denormalized to such a large extent that right now, not only is the norm to consume music that's pre-recorded and passively ingested, but it has become extremely individualistic in that as well, and only increasingly so as technology has made things smaller and easier to carry around
more
with
portable.
Us and more mobile and accessible and cheaper. So, you know, now with our phones and AirPods, you know, we can live in our own singular individual experience of art, and we can go on our entire lives without communal experiences of art.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the creation of the Sony Walkman? Like, did you ever hear the story about that?
I think I heard it recently, just on a random YouTube video about, but go ahead and share it.
So it's apparently the guy who invented it had created this thing. It was just something he had rigged up. He worked for Sony, and he had it so that he could listen to music by himself with his headphones and whatnot. And he tried to pitch it to the Sony executives and said, you know, this is the future of listening to music, like by yourself on your headphones, not with other people. And they said, there's no way that's ever going to work. Like, he had to fight to get that idea through. And I mean, once it was pushed through, obviously, you know, it made huge amounts of money and people were like, absolutely, we love this idea. But it's interesting to me that even, I mean, that would have been maybe 50 years ago or 40 years ago when that was being developed. And even then, people just didn't think of art as something to be consumed individually.
Mm-hmm.
To be received individually, so much so that executives who were all about making money, it's not like they were doing it for conscience reasons or anything like that. Like, they just did not think it was going to be marketable. And it's interesting, that's how far our shift in thinking has come since then, that such an idea as that, like the individual curated algorithm for your individual tastes, all in this sort of vacuum of individual personal reality, is the norm now. And even, you know, a few decades ago, it was so much not the norm even then that people were like, that wouldn't even sell. That's not even marketable.
Yeah, like the changes from the old norm have happened in steps. Is the first change was from the necessity of live performance to the option of recorded music instead. But because of the manner of getting that to people, it was still primarily a communal thing. You know, when my mom shares stories with me about the music she loved when she was a kid or a teenager, most of her stories are something along the lines of, me and my friends loved this song and would, you know, sing it as, you know, they drove around in their car. right? There was still that communal element to it that came with radios, basically.
Right. Gather around the radio and have your family time.
Yeah.
You know, the family radio show.
And so, like, the communal element of the artist being in the room, you know, mm-hmm. got taken away first. And then the communal element of other people enjoying it with you, like with the Walkman and similar things, it got removed next. And so now that has even been accepted as the general norm, where now it's kind of an odd thing for, you know, families to sit around the living room and just listen to music together.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of considered a hoity-toity high-class thing, or mm-hmm. or just a rare and really special thing to, like, go to orchestras in person. You know, it's not the standard American who goes out every weekend to see an opera or a musical of some sort.
Right. Or even a movie, like movie theaters as well have struggled to keep up as, like, yeah. streaming becomes the norm, and people even streaming on their phones. I mean, it's interesting how this has shifted the way they're making movies. They mm-hmm. have to think about what will this look like on a handheld device, because it's not necessarily going to be viewed the first time or even any time on a huge screen with a yeah. premium sound system, you know, yeah. like that's actually shifted the way people are making movies.
Yeah. And, you know, for the sake of Renew the Arts' mission being to renew all the arts, you know, mm-hmm. I think, you know, with the bulk of Porchlight being musicians and me being primarily a musician, a lot of this conversation is going to be about music, but we have seen similar things occur across most mediums of art. And I think there are a lot of interesting parallels with movies that we'll probably get into across the conversation.
Definitely. And the death of theater, which is still a thing where it's like, you know, you can film a play, and many people have done film adaptations of various different plays, but it's definitely a completely different experience. Mm-hmm. Even the way of presenting it is different. Actors who have to get used to close-ups as opposed to exaggerating their facial features or the volume of their voice to carry mm-hmm. Over a room. I mean, that's a very different technique. And we've noticed also that a lot of musicals are not really being experienced by people first in a theater. And I don't mean a movie theater. I mean like a stage theater. It's also the case with visual art, where going to a museum to see the original, well, I don't necessarily have to go and see the original. I have images of that image on my computer or on my phone, and it's becoming easier and easier for me to get a semi-realistic experience even of a museum, mm-hmm. a walkthrough at a museum that's a virtual walkthrough, and I don't have to be there in person. And what do you think we're losing? Like, what is this shift, this overall shift that's occurred? Are we gaining something? And if we are, what is that? And what are we losing? Like, yeah. what has been lost?
I will make no claims at being able to answer these questions thoroughly. I think
okay,
what have we gained opinion. And what have we lost are of massive scope. And to some extent, mm-hmm. I don't think we even know yet. I think as far as what we've lost, there's a potential cultural and psychological fallout that's probably still ahead of us in our future mm-hmm. that might be more severe than we could even predict, not to be pessimistic mm-hmm. about it. And, you know, even the things that we've gained, I think, tend to have drawbacks. And the easiest mm-hmm. thing is, like, accessibility is the primary mm-hmm. thing that we've gained. People who live very far away from a museum, as you said, might be able to do a virtual walkthrough or see pictures of the pieces online, you know, watch a video of an art gallery presentation, things that are in theory really cool. And it does, how does one say, democratize, socialize, you know, the access to this art.
Yeah.
But I mean, along with it comes a sort of ADHD relationship with the art that, again, like I mentioned this earlier, I think passivity is a big issue mm-hmm. to, you know, simply receive it without a more active participation in the mm-hmm. art, which I think is especially true of music. And I'll switch back gears to that in a second. But even, you know, in the museum example, when you're walking through a museum and you're in a physical space, the art is asking something of you that you have to physically walk away from in order to kind of get away from a piece of art. But it's asking you to really just sit there and just look at it, and to spend as much time as you want. And you aren't just a simple, tiny little click away from Xing out of a tab or moving along to the next image. You have to get up and take physical steps in order to just get a few feet away from that image so that you can focus on the next one. And I think most people who've had in-person experiences with thoughtful, well-made pieces of visual art, there's something that comes from just like the letting it look back at you, you know, the kind of allowing a piece of art to stare into your own soul as you stare into its, that is not impossible from looking at a picture of it on a computer screen, by no means, but the change in medium is not well suited toward that sort of relationship with the art. And so that is true of music as well. There is nothing about, well, shouldn't say nothing, but there's nothing inherently constrictive about listening to recorded art on a phone or computer or what have you that keeps you from having a very soulish moment with the art, of being really tuned in to what is happening through this recorded performance. That, you know, I think it's worth stating here that if we're not talking about AI music, we are talking about music that was at one point in time actually performed by actual humans, right? So like there is a performance element that is just jumping across space and time in order for you to experience that performance in a different context. So it's not like recorded music isn't performed. And I say all this as like a very big fan of recorded music. Like I do think recorded music as a possibility is a net positive for humanity. But again, it's the manner in which we engage with it that is primarily problematic. And the fact that we are listening to, you know, curated playlists on Spotify that just kind of play as background noise, and that we have culturally gotten used to music just constantly being on the background of our shops and stores and movies and what have you, is a huge element in what is kind of teaching us and retraining us to have a relationship with music where it's not actually about engaging with the art. It's not actually about singing along or thinking about the lyrics or letting, you know, the song work on you as a person. It's just pleasant noise for the background of your busy life.
The Renew the Arts podcast is doing our mailbag episode a bit differently in 2025. We're going to start collecting mailbag questions now from the mailbag episode coming in December. So if you have any questions, objections, or comments about this episode or about arts and faith in general, go ahead and send them to us. Go to renewthearts.org/mailbag to submit your questions or comments. So even the jump from a museum to looking at something on your computer, when you're in a museum and you're standing in front of a piece, there is something different that happens in the sense that this object was actually made by another person. It was created. And even if you're not conscious of that, I think part of the difference of the experience is that there's a personal interaction, not just with the art as an object to be consumed, but with the art as something that has been made by another person, and you're actually relating to the person who made it as much as you're relating to the thing that you're considering in front of you. And that's obviously way more the case with a live performance of any kind, where you can see the artist or you can actually experience the presence of the artist in that moment. That's a very personal experience, and it changes things pretty drastically. Mm-hmm. But it's also that depersonalization goes as far as saying it's changed the way that we make art. If we think about records made in the 60s or 70s, that is much closer to a human performance, and you can feel that it's a human performance. It's not quantized. It's not auto-tuned. It's not fixed in such a way as to be an object for consumption. The mistakes that were in there from the players who played it and their style and their feel and everything like that, and even the way the band played together as a unit is oftentimes recorded into that experience so that you can listen to the record and feel like, I could have heard them play this and it would have been like this. This mm-hmm. is a record of what they did, as opposed to something that has been manufactured and is almost inhuman in its nature of making, and in the way that it's chopped up into pieces and perfected and quantized and tuned, so that there's so many layers between me and the artist that I'm not really having a personal experience anymore. And then add to that the depersonalization that occurs with listening to it by myself on my phone with my headphones. I mean, truly, like I'm worlds away from interacting with this art as a personal engagement, mm-hmm. and it's become a depersonalized experience almost entirely. It's a consumption of an object rather than a subjective experience of interaction with another creator or another person.
Yeah,
does that make sense at all?
Yeah, and I could play devil's advocate with that a bit.
I love it. Go.
So there's one sense in which I completely agree, and another sense in which I think there is a possibility for recorded music to be a different type of art than live performance. Mm-hmm. I'll start with the point that I agree with. Prior to the modern advancements in audio editing tools and software and whatnot, the art of recording music was putting the best live performance possible to tape, and so that mm-hmm. you are presenting to as many people as possible the best performance of a song. And it was, you know, back in those days, chiefly recorded live, or, you know, mm-hmm. the musicians recording basically live and then the singers recording live on top of that. Mm-hmm. So that is a beautiful thing that is lost to a lot of people in modern music, with, as you said, pitching the vocals and quantizing drums and doing things that are just plainly impossible from a live performance standpoint. And I think we have basically been chasing more robotic music mm-hmm. in our desire for perfection in the recorded arts. And so, you know, most artists are desiring drums that effectively lack character and vocals that lack any error or modulation from, you know, perfect pitch. And the normalization of those practices is one of the things that's allowing AI music to be so passable. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to go off on a huge AI tangent, but just...
We'll have that interview later.
Yeah. but just as an example, like, if you put an AI production next to a 60s recording from the Four Tops or something, mm-hmm. the difference is very clear. You're mm-hmm. getting only perfect sounds from AI. And because we've spent the past 25 years trying to make most musical artists as robotically perfect as possible, our ears are trained to accept that as being what humans sound like. Mm-hmm. So that's me agreeing with you. The disagreeing element, I say, as, you know, full disclosure, a recording artist who does like pitch correct my vocals and quantize my drums and mm-hmm. and things like that. I do think the recorded art has the possibility as an art form to primarily be about presenting your musical composition rather than primarily being about presenting your performance of that composition. Mm-hmm. You know, if I want a very specific drum beat that I can't actually play mm-hmm. as part of the song that I've written, that becomes possible. You know, if I'm really struggling to hit a certain note mm-hmm. that is part of the song that I've written. You know, I can bump the notes into the spot that I wrote it to be mm-hmm. and therefore allow you to hear the song that's in my head despite my own personal shortcomings as a performer. And so I think there's validity in that that's similar to the process that an author goes through between...
In revising.
Yeah, in revising. You know, you have mm-hmm. the messy first draft of a book and then it goes through usually multiple rounds of editing, right? I do book editing as well. And so like there's copy editing, there's developmental editing, there's line editing, there's all mm-hmm. these different stages that a book goes through. And most books that hit a Barnes & Noble shelf have gone through 3, 4, maybe more rounds of editing in order to reach a level of quote unquote perfection that is suitable for widespread publication. And for that art form, we generally don't consider that as being
a bad thing.
A deterioration on the the authenticity of the art that was made.
Right. But if that's all we had, so for instance, an author might go on a book tour where they answer questions or they give a TED talk or something like this. And even though that's still prepared, there's also a sense in which more of the personality and flubs and bluster of the original person is coming through.
Yeah.
And there is some value and benefit in that. I mean, we still do appreciate hearing an authentic and natural voice, hearing conversations between people with all the different rabbit trails and red herrings that people go on. And that still is an enjoyable personal thing. I mean, it's a different thing, is what I'm saying.
Yes.
It's a different thing.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I think the expectation of audiences and the constriction of technology maybe have removed that more personal reality and more communal reality from being a part of the arts in general.
Yeah.
And in a sense, I guess I would say that was the original question. If we're gaining this other thing, where we can create more accessible works, accessible to more people, and also more accessible even to the artist to be able to create things. Otherwise, they would have needed a record label to even be able to start to begin to make. And even then, there would have been limitations to mm-hmm. that in terms of their imagination. So now, like, your imagination is the limit as far as what you can create. And budgets are not as constrictive because all of this material and these tools are available to even an individual artist. And you have access to huge, wide variety of audiences mm-hmm. Because of the fact that you can just deliver it electronically over, you know, thousands and thousands of miles without being there. And they can listen to it and experience it way more times than you would ever have the stamina to replay it yourself.
Yeah.
You know, all these kinds of things.
Right.
That's all amazing. And I would say, you know, fantastic. But if we're losing this communal aspect of the receiving of the arts, the communal aspect of the making of the arts, and this personal connection between the people who are receiving the art and the people who are making it, what does that cause us to lose? Like, what are we losing in that?
Right. And yeah, so coming back to the, like, what have we lost? I'm glad I was able to go on that devil's advocate tangent because I don't want to come on here and sound like I'm just anti-movies and anti-recorded music, right? But as I mentioned earlier, we're on this pendulum swing where we have so wholeheartedly accepted and normalized these absolutely earth-shattering, paradigm-shifting advancements in technology that it's not just the new option, it's the complete replacement of what
right.
we had.
It's like the only option.
Right. It's treated generally as the only option by the bulk of our society. And by so thoroughly replacing the old, very human, very communal norms, I think we've completely lost touch as a society with why God gave us music in the first place. Can I go on my The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings?
Lord of the Rants.
Lord of the Rants.
Yes, please go on your Lord of the Rants.
This is a little bit of kind of why this topic has been so on my mind lately.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm reading through the Tolkien classics for my first time. And it's been an interesting experience reading the books with all these years of hearsay and kind of cultural conversation and critiques in my head around them. You know, I'm very familiar with the issues that people have with Tolkien's writing style, as well as why people love it. But one of the most divisive elements of his writing is the pretty consistent inclusion of songs.
Mm-hmm.
Like I know people both in person and online who have stated openly that as much as they love these books, they skip over the songs and just don't bother with them and they don't enjoy them. And I had a kind of a big light bulb moment as I've been reading through first The Hobbit and now about halfway through Fellowship of why these songs are so important, but also why they're so weird to us in this modern situation we find ourselves in, is that like this is the only music they had.
Mm-hmm.
If you and I were to go on some 10-hour road trip together, it would be bizarre to spend that 10 hours never putting a CD on, never turning the radio on. You know, we take it for granted that our lives have been filled with this recorded form of music. That, you know, for ages past, on week-long carriage rides across the country, on massive hikes or journeys where...
Pilgrimages,
right. Where electricity wasn't a thing, cars weren't a thing. I think most of us would lose our minds thinking about those being these huge periods of time where we didn't get to have any art, didn't get to have any music. You know, your only option for road trip playlists and mix CDs 100 years ago was you singing and your pilgrim mates or like carriage mates singing to you, singing with you. And that completely turned my head around in terms of the importance of the songs in these books and why they show up so often. Like, of course, they're singing songs to each other as they walk for days on end. Of course, they're singing songs to encourage each other because that's what we still do. We listen to songs to encourage ourselves and to fill up the silence on long journeys and to bring peace during stressful moments and stressful seasons. So like music exists for the same reasons and accomplish the same purposes, except it's become more passive and less communal. The thing that I think we should fight against, that I personally want to fight against, and that I think Renew the Arts and Porchlight are already fighting against, is that we've moved so far from that, that the idea of asking just a buddy to sing a song to you or with you is very strange.
Yeah.
And we're just, again, only a few generations removed from that being your only option to experience music, where it was a normal thing 150 years ago, granted, maybe for more for the upper class, to gather in a living room and take turns, you know, playing the piano for each other, singing songs for each other. That's like a staple of... No, I'm saying all classes would do a version of this. The thing that I'm picturing is like Jane Austen.
I'm thinking like chain gang songs, you know? I mean, like these are the lowest of the lows, you know? Like
no, it absolutely existed for all classes.
Yeah.
If you think of like the Negro spirituals, they sang to survive and they made up songs that have now, like some of them have lasted, you know, through the ages because that's what they needed to do to get through the... I would say arduous, but that you know doesn't even get that's too
life too crushing, brutal environment. Yeah.
So the high class thing that I was mentioning, the upper class thing, was me, like I'm picturing in my head like a scene from a Jane Austen movie,
like
a bunch
parlor.
Of people, right, like in a giant like parlor together, taking turns with the violin and piano, playing classical music for each other. But yeah, different versions of that existed for all people groups, all societies, you know, all countries and languages. You know, families singing hymns together, you know, singing nursery rhymes to your kids before going to sleep at night, which like some of that is still normal. You know, I sing to my daughter all the time, but you know, there are also parents who just like, they have a little baby light, you know, that does the music for you or put on a Miss Rachel video, to sing the songs for you. Again, it's like there's nothing in our society that requires you personally, physically to be the person to provide music to a friend or family member or to yourself. And so that removal that has been granted to us is, I really think, something that we should push back against and reclaim and renormalize, because I think that is the greatest loss we're facing.
Yeah, and I think one of the unforeseen consequences of that actually has been in the way that artists consider their position in terms of their audience. Mm-hmm. And I've seen this a lot. Think about, you know, your Tolkien example or the Chain Gang or even Austin's Entertainment Parlor. The songs they're singing and the things that are being produced are almost certainly local. They have almost certainly been made with a particular real audience in mind. And they're being sung from one person to another person for their particular entertainment or edification. And if you're like, eh, I don't like that song, let's not sing that song. It doesn't get sung. And you have a different song, you know? And it's like real-time feedback on a local community. And that actually does constrain or at least direct the kinds of art that's being made by your local troubadours or whoever else, your poets, your storytellers. That's shaping the kinds of stories they tell, the kinds of songs they sing, the way that they do it, where they, you know, it's like, you're my audience. This is my audience right here. I can look in your faces. And that does change the way art is made. If you think about artists today, they don't necessarily have an audience right in front of them. They don't necessarily have the faces of the people they're going to be singing to in mind while they're making a song. What are they trying to get? Well, they're trying to get on a playlist. Mm-hmm. They're trying to get, you know, national notoriety, get a big enough name that totally unknown people are singing their songs. So what are you going to sing about then? I mean, think about even in Tolkien, the dwarves have the dwarven songs about dwarven culture and dwarven stories and dwarven history and dwarven, et cetera. And the elves have their own things and the humans mm-hmm. have their own things. And it's the same way. If you're like, well, I'm not necessarily making music or art for a community I know, but rather for the most generic of communities, the faceless masses, then you have to start removing all those particularities from your work, because that is going to limit its audience potentially. And so all of a sudden you start having, I mean, think about like praise and worship songs that are being made in such a way that they can be sung by any church no matter their experience. You know, it's like, well, how generic does it have to be in order to have an infinite potential audience? It has to be 100% generic, so derivative that, again, I mean, we talked about it, we referenced it slightly earlier, but AI is able to create a lot of these things mm-hmm. and they're passable. You listen yeah. to them, and it's like, that's actually passable. How is it so passable? It's because they are doing, human beings are being required to do a similar thing in the creation of these things to make it as generic and derivative as possible so that it has an unlimited potential audience. That has changed the arts massively, like yeah. almost fundamentally. And I think that's probably one of the biggest things we've lost is that sense of being able to picture in your mind the people that you're writing for, the people that you're actually creating for. That changes the art that's made massively, like fundamentally.
Yeah, it's generally considered good advice in a lot of like artistic and, you know, songwriting circles and whatnot to think solely about the art you're making first and then only start thinking about your audience later when you're doing like the release and the marketing and all that. And that is actually good advice when your primary goals are one, self-expression, and two, to find as much success as possible through your own right. self-expression. One issue with that is that I don't think self-expression should be the end-all be-all of art. And the other issue with that is that I think it's impossible for people to actually not be thinking about their audience unless they're actually just making it for themselves and never going exactly. to share it with anyone and happily, gladly putting music on their computer that is never going to see the light of day.
It is interesting, though, that if you have an audience of one and that audience is yourself, you do have a better chance of making something that is authentic and timeless art. Mm-hmm. I mean, sure. authentic and timeless art has been made with merely an audience of one. But I agree with you. If that's the only potential audience you're ever writing for, that's pretty limiting.
Yeah. And again, it's like we can, I think, delude ourselves into thinking that we're not thinking about our audience while we're making art. But, you know, most of the time there is that sense of, I want this to sell. Like, I'm wanting the largest audience possible. or I am trying to get on the 80s vibes playlist, and they expect certain sounds and certain specific BPM for your song. Like, the playlistification of modern music is so strange because it expects artists to make such niche, kind of predetermined decisions in the music they're making in order to fit the feel and vibe and general requirements of a playlist that, you know, you end up making your music for those specifications, for that playlist and for that playlist audience before you're considering, you know, anything else. But the widespread trend, I guess you could say, of a lot of American churches now making their own music is a really amazing opportunity to be writing songs for their own congregation. And so many of these churches kind of very quickly miss the mark and get their priorities mixed up because they end up chasing that success and the possibility of writing a song that could be sung all over the globe rather than focusing on their own denomination. And so,
or
that,
their own congregation, yeah, sure.
The churches represent an example of this that I think more just regular artists should also be thinking about. Like, you might not have a congregation per se, but who is your audience? And, you know, what do you want to say to them? How do you want to encourage or edify or challenge the specific group of people that God has already placed in your proximity or within even your digital reach? But I do think that type of making music for a specific audience rather than making it for the biggest audience possible does ultimately change how and why you make the art. And you will make different decisions with how you produce your music, with how you write your lyrics, with what risks you take versus what safe pre-established routes you go down. And those are all really vital things in terms of the ultimate quality and value of the art you're making.
Right. It's going to naturally increase the diversity of the art that's being made as well, because you end up having art made for individual communities, which are going to be very different. They're going to be unique. To do our vital work, Renew the Arts depends on voluntary support from dedicated patrons like you. We would love if you partnered with us financially at renewthearts.org/donate. Another great thing you can do for us right now is leave a rating and review wherever you are listening to this podcast. That helps other people discover our podcast and our work. Thank you so much for listening and partnering with us. We greatly appreciate it.
I think that's one of the lies that we're facing of the mass individualism of the modern music industry. There's so many niches. You know, it's like Spotify had all these dumb genres. Like, your genre of choice is mid-afternoon goblin core. Like, it's like you're making stuff up. Like, what is this nonsense? You know, it's like there are actually just thousands of artists making very similar music in very specific niches. It's not actually as diverse as you might think. Like, you as a consumer can go in and see a million different niches that you can dive into, which feels very diverse. But then once you're inside of your niche, it's a lot of people just doing the same thing. And it is just another way that we are kind of distancing ourselves from the communal power of singing together, singing for one another, writing specific songs for specific situations, which again is like another kind of Tolkien thing. It's like sometimes they're singing pre-established songs of, you know, dwarven lore or hobbit lore or whatever, but then they also just make up little ditties on the spot that are just about the situation they're in. And we want more of that. And, you know, to have porch-like concerts where artists are maybe writing a song just for that show, or, you know, very specifically tailoring their set list and their stories for that audience at that show. And then, yeah, and then getting to enjoy it in person with the people and singing along, which even singing along, you know, is something that's getting lost. Like, there are a lot of people who go to churches and don't sing.
Right.
You know, their experience in the worship service is just standing there and sitting there and listening to the music. Not valueless, but distanced from the point of it, from how powerful it is to engage physically and personally in the partaking of art.
Yeah. And participating in it, like actively. Yeah. So you're definitely right. And that definitely is one of, again, the consequences of our centralized and virtualized and depersonalized art consumption, is that we have been driven to be more passive, more spectator, and less participating. We talked about this, too, at the in-person gathering, a lot of the difficulties that we've had trying to create a culture around Porchlight in these various different communities, mm-hmm. that a lot of people will view a Porchlight event as an event, and it's kind of a rare and mm-hmm. strange occurrence to have people at their house and then to come around and gather around something beautiful. Whereas if you think about entertaining, like you said, before the last 100 years, that would have been a fairly normal occurrence. It would have been a fairly average, expected kind of a thing, where it's like, you've got the pianoforte, it's in the parlor, we're all going to retire to the parlor after dinner, and we're going mm-hmm. to play some songs. You know what I mean? Like, listen to some songs.
Yeah.
And yeah, sure, that's middle upper class, but even still, you have after a hard day's work, over a meal, you eat your meal, you tell stories, you sing songs to one another, or tell poems, you know, recite poems to one another. That would have been a very common occurrence. It would have been almost an everyday occurrence, if not at least a regular occurrence. And then you obviously have like your church services where everybody gets together and sings songs together. That would have been very, very normal. We live in a culture where that's not as normal, where it's actually, you know, like you said, even in a place where you might expect some participation, more and more spectatorship and less participation, and that's becoming the norm. How do you renormalize? I mean, that was the kind of the question we're asking at the in-person strategic planning. It's like, how do we renormalize this communal sharing of the arts in this mutual space? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I always have too many thoughts. I think Christianity, the church in general, is doing a decent job holding on to this. Mm-hmm. Like, some of the few ways in our society that we still see kind of a widespread participation in people singing to each other, for each other, with each other, is in the context of worship gatherings and Sunday morning church services, or families who do family worship together every night or every morning and sing hymns together. Like, that's a very beautiful and practical example of this idea being renormalized. And another, I guess you could say, secular, kind of outside of the church bastion of society where we see a little bit of this is the campfire circle.
Mm-hmm.
That's the probably most normal thing I can point to where this practice hasn't been completely lost. You know, the idea of like, you know, people who went camping together mm-hmm. and there's a dozen of them sitting on logs around a campfire, and one of them asks, hey, did anyone bring a guitar? Mm-hmm. You know, and then you play songs, you take turns. Like, that is a really good example of something that still kind of gets treated too much as a special occasion.
Mm-hmm.
And that event mentality is something that we need to fix in order to renormalize this practice, that it can also just be you hanging out at your house. Like, it doesn't have to be the one time a year where you go camping.
Right.
You know, it doesn't, even for Christians, it doesn't have to be just Sunday mornings. A lot of Christians go to life groups or community groups together, whatever you want to call them.
Right.
That is another occasion where, like, you can all just sing together. You don't need someone even playing an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
Even just like singing something as short and simple as the doxology
mm-hmm.
are small but meaningful steps we can take toward reintroducing something into our lives that was normal and standard and debatably necessary
right.
for human surviving and thriving. for thousands of years. And it also, and here's another big issue and another thing that kind of needs to be kind of toppled is the celebrity mentality that has been created alongside the recording industry, that music is just for the artists. We need to dismantle that so that it is just open to everyone present to sing along. You know, you don't have to be an artist or even a quote-unquote good singer to participate in these activities and to find healthy, soul-nourishing experiences through participating in art and making it together, singing songs to your friends, or writing a song for your friends, you know?
Yeah. I think that was one of the things that a couple of people talked about, because we were looking at various different communities within the larger Porchlight ecosphere that actually had worked pretty well, like actually developed and kind of popped, had a culture that actually became self-sustaining. And in each of those cases, like in Rochester, in our president, Katie, she had Taco Tuesdays, and that was a thing that happened every week. And so she was already used to inviting people over. There's already a space for hospitality that people had grown accustomed to. And so when she started to have Porchlight concerts and she just had them fall on one of the Taco Tuesdays. So it's like 3 weeks out of this month, we're going to have Taco Tuesday. One of the weeks out of this month, we're actually going to have an artist here and we're going to have Taco Tuesday plus Porchlight event. That so much more sustainable and functioned so much better. And it wasn't so much a great effort to make that happen. Similar thing has happened in our community, although our Porchlight events are still very event feeling, but we have people here all the time. Like the last Porchlight event that we had, there was a mess up with the RSVP where the address came up wrong. Something was copied and pasted wrong in the Eventbrite. So it was like, it was supposed to be in Georgia, but the address that came up was in New Hampshire. So I'm like, anybody who got that, it was for like another Porchlight concert at some other place. Anyway, I'm airing dirty laundry here. But here's the thing. We still had about 40 people at our Porchlight event because my extended family constitutes about that. Like my friend and family group here, we have regular gatherings that are that size. And so it was pretty unchallenging to make that happen. It wasn't what I hoped, and I was very sad about the fact that a lot of people who could have been involved weren't there, but it still wasn't a total disaster because there was already a culture here in our environment of having people gathered and regularly, like regularly gathering and spending time together. Remember when I was a younger parent, and I have five kids, and my younger kids were doing pretty well, like being involved in church and participating, and they were They're really great about this now. Like, you know, my eldest are 17 now. My youngest is 10. So they're all at the age where I could actually have a reasonable conversation with them and be like, hey, can you stop making a bunch of noise and yelling at the top of your lungs and stuff like that? Like, they wouldn't even do that. But when, you know, they're 2 or 3 or 4 years old, it's a bigger ask, even for church, to have you be like, hey, can you participate? Can you sit here and can you listen to a sermon or sing along with everybody else? And we had, when we were fairly young parents, we had seen that there were some other parents that had pretty good participation from their young kids. And we were like, hey, what are you doing? And they said, well, we can't expect our kids to participate on Sunday and like be good participants on Sunday if they don't have this basically every day. And so they had something similar to, you know, this family worship where it's like, okay, you're two, but we're all going to sit here and we're going to sing together and we're going to read together and we're going to talk together. And this is a time when we're all, you know, actively engaging with each other. And then, you know, on Sunday, that wasn't a weird thing because even the little kids had already kind of gotten enculturated into that during the week. And I feel like on a bigger scale, that's kind of what we're trying to do. And what I would recommend Porchlight hosts do is rather than having these like 3 events a year or something like that, like really try and create a culture where these communal sharings of, you know, mutual dignity and respect, because this is really what it's about. It's you're granting somebody else attention beyond just yourself. And it's something that you actually have to give them respect and dignity. And that's a discipline and a virtue that is soul shaping. And I think losing that is a massive loss. It's a massive loss yep. to society because we've become entitled narcissists and selfish people almost as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And so it's like, well, if you're going to counteract that, how do you do that? Well, it's these disciplines of mutual sharing and mutual respect giving and mutual attention giving that I think we've just lost. It's we've lost it in the fabric of our culture. And I think Porchlight is a great way to reinvigorate that part of our culture that could have profound impacts on our culture as a whole.
Yeah, I completely agree that both hosting Porchlight shows and attending them is one of the ways that we can fight back against these shifts and renormalize this essential part of humanity. But I think there's also like ways that we can put on Porchlight shows that will be exhausting. And that's the event thing. The celebrity thing. It's, you know, treating it as like, okay, I need to make my house pristinely perfect and cook better food than I've ever made before and make my house feel like it's a model home for for Airbnb or something, and then be the perfect host where my kids obey perfectly and, you know, they're not crazy or loud at all. Like, those are the things that I imagine make a Porchlight host want to only do one or two shows a year.
The stress of getting people there too.
And that's kind of the where the event mentality comes on the like attender side. Mm-hmm. You know, as someone going to a show, you view it as this special thing that you like, oh yeah, I'll go to the first one you've invited me to, but then it's not special anymore. And I'm not going to come to the next Porchlight show you put on. That's also missing the point because it's not supposed to be a special thing. It is best for us when it becomes just like, oh yeah, like it's another Friday night. Let's see if there's a house show I can go to. Yeah. And so just having that normalcy of, you know, your house will be about as clean as it usually is, and your kids will be as loud and crazy as they usually are. And you're inviting people into the realness of your circumstance and providing hospitality. That's not trying to entertain people, but that's being a vessel for community and for the communal participation and enjoyment of art together.
Yeah.
And like things like family worship are a microcosm of that, that helps create the normalcy where kids can grow up saying like, oh man, my dad sucks at singing, but that didn't stop him from singing hymns with us every night. And I say that as an example. My father is actually a better singer than I am. but that's the point. Like it's like my dad didn't have to sound like a member of the Backstreet Boys in order for him to sing hymns with me every day. Like that's the kind of thing that would be amazing for kids to grow up with. And now more important than ever, because what are the alternatives? You know, their alternatives are slop on YouTube and who knows what the algorithm is feeding them and music on Spotify that might have been made by robots. It's hard to tell.
Might as well have been made by robots.
Yeah. And so we offer alternatives that are human and interpersonal. But I think another way in which Porchlight shows and similar environments and mediums for partaking in art together, another reason it's really important is because our current state in society, especially post-pandemic, is like we're losing our medium-sized spaces and our medium-sized art. I'm not the first person to say this. There are thousands of YouTube video essays that make this point. But something that's disappeared from modern cinema for the most part is the mid-budget movie. That your options are basically an indie film that was made for less than $10 million.
That you're not seeing at the movie theater either, unless you're going to some art house.
Right. Yeah. Or a blockbuster that costs, you know, $100 million or more. You know, $200 and $300 million movies are becoming increasingly common. So that like middle ground that is being lost, that is kind of this like, there's money being put into this, there's a lot of art and effort and original ideas, that's disappearing from the cinema landscape. And something similar that I think is not being talked about as much is how that is basically happening in music as well. Because again, especially post-pandemic, but the foundations were already being laid for this over the past in the Spotify era, for the most part, is that smaller venues aren't surviving and smaller record labels aren't surviving. A lot of really great record labels that were able to invest in more artistic bands that weren't making music for large audiences, those record labels have largely stopped altogether and shut their doors, or they're not really able to fund the artists anymore, and they're more just like distribution and advertising partners who depend on the artists to produce their own music or to crowdfund their own music.
Yeah.
If you go back 20, 30 years, there were a lot of independent record labels that were successfully able to act as kind of like patrons and banks for artists that didn't appeal to this mass market level of your Michael Jacksons and Elvis Presleys, but, you know, still were great artists making great music, and to get them out to sizable audiences to the point of being able to make careers out of their music. And so that is disappearing. And even like the venues where those artists could perform, you know, smaller venues that they could ostensibly sell out are gone. And so now we're largely left with our major labels and our big stadiums and amphitheaters. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we have our indie artists and our self-produced artists and ones who play like little acoustic house shows, or who don't have a venue to perform at all. Mm-hmm. Like, not only is that like medium space no longer a viable option for most people to try, even attempt to make a career out of their music, but we have this increasing, you know, amount of artists probably all around us, no matter where you live, who would love to have a community for their art and to be able to make some money off of it and to find some support that they're never going to get on a wide scale because they're not trying to make music that will appeal on the level of a Sabrina Carpenter song. And they don't want to have a song that, you know, goes for that audience because that would go against what they're trying to achieve artistically. And so doing things like becoming a Porchlight host, you're opening yourself up to the possibility of finding those artists and helping them have a small local, not even following, but genuine community.
Correct. A partnership.
Yeah. Where they can actually like write music for you and speak into your soul and speak into your situation and have genuine relationships beyond just fan celebrity, beyond simply like parasocial, and to get back to the normalization of communal art participation while supporting the small but integral artists who will struggle to find support elsewhere.
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing. I mean, we've been trying to do that for a lot of years, and the celebrity Christian idea, the spectatorship feedback, vicious feedback loop that's been created, the centralization of art, the individualization of art consumption, all of these things are things that are fighting really against us. And they have massive money behind them and a huge amount of like overarching support.
Yeah.
Whereas we're considered maybe even Luddite, you know, anti-progress to be like, oh, you want to go back to the days of the hobbits, you know, like that's even longer, you know, ages ago. And this idea that none of that is necessary. But at the same time, if we're just looking at society as it is with the rise of therapy, like therapy has become normalized, not just because we're all emotionally healthy and humble enough to be willing to receive it. It's because more and more people need it than ever.
Right. It's another one of those pendulum swings.
Yeah.
It's like 70 years ago, not enough people were getting therapy.
Yeah.
Nowadays, too many people need therapy.
Exactly.
Like something wrong has happened. I was talking to a friend this morning about someone in his ministry that has been using ChatGPT as a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those like, it's
dubious.
it's sad that like a level of desperation or perhaps a lack of, you know, finances or whatever, like led them to that as being the so-called solution. But it's also that debatably going to the problem as your solution.
As your solution, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think that a lot of the things we're talking about, again, subtle effects, maybe people haven't necessarily thought about it, but this interpersonal mutuality and communion of human beings, the communion of the saints that we talk about within the church, that is a massive, massive structural load-bearing wall when it comes to mental health that is either totally removed in most people's lives or has never been there. And it's so important, actually, that people have real people around them that they spend time with and that they can count on and that they're sharing things that make life worth living. Good food, good music, good stories. They need to be able to share those things and be able to experience those things face-to-face, interpersonally, in order to have the kind of hope that is able to hold up against despair and the fragmentation of society.
Yeah.
I want to see that. I want to see us all go back in that direction. I think it's a really important part of our lives that we're missing out on. But yeah, so give us your final thoughts on this, Chase. And then I want to ask you to share a little bit about your own work and tell me where people can find out about you.
Well, I didn't prepare like a final thought, but I'll just go off of what you just said and see where it takes us. Of all the people who like legitimately need therapy, probably the people who most need it are the people who would never get it, right? And that type of person might be the person who attends church every week strictly as a spectator sport, who are going through the motions of showing up on a Sunday morning, attending the concert, listening to the sermon, not actually engaging with the humans around them, and then going straight home afterwards. You know, that is a facsimile of, you know, what the communion of the saints really should be. And a lot of it comes from the celebrity mentality, the concert mentality, the event mentality that, again, we are now a few generations into treating as the norm. And just a little bit of effort plus historical context can help us begin to break down those cultural givens, you know, and to reject them on the basis of what has been true throughout history and what we should actually be doing in order to obey like the biblical commands for community and hospitality, and to take those and just make small steps. There, unfortunately, is not a future ahead of us where Renew the Arts and Porchlight are going to bring an end to the monolithic music industry that generates, you know, billions of dollars every year. You and I will not be able to bring down Spotify and, you know, get music listeners to actually buy music again and to better appreciate live music.
Yeah.
But what we can do on our own personal level, in our own households, with our own neighborhoods and churches and communities, is to just make these small steps that reintroduce communal art into our lives that can be as simple as like every now and then turning to your spouse, brother, friend, you want to jam? You know, or like, hey, you want to just pull out this hymn book and just sing a few songs together? Can we introduce a family worship into our regimen? Now I'm going to play songs for my like 2-year-old daughter, like whatever it is, like those are the little decisions that fight back, because we can't expect these changes to come top down. They have to be bottom up. It will only work on the grassroots. And it's intended to be a grassroots thing.
Right. Because it couldn't work any other way. It's like, it's like forcing someone into freedom. It doesn't work.
Right. It is only a local community thing. And so we can hope that it will spread slowly as a grassroots thing to help turn the clock and rebalance the pendulum to fix some of the issues and some of the losses that we've accumulated over these past 100 years. But the best that you can personally hope for is to make those small changes within your own community.
Mm-hmm.
And if your household, if your neighborhood, if your church starts doing this in a more holistic, healthy, historical way, then you've won.
Mm-hmm. Even if just for your community, it's worth it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking with me today, Chase. Now, let me know, where can people find you and engage with your rather prolific output? I just want to say, because you might not even say this, one of the things that I really appreciated, I went on your website, looked around a little bit, you have a songwriting service. So people who mm-hmm. want songs written for their particular occasion, you write songs for particular occasions or for particular people, which I think is a really amazing extension of what we're even talking about right now, that really does create a mutual space and a partnership in the making of art. So I appreciated that a lot. So anyway, just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, that's something I've been doing for about a decade now. You know, it's hard to find business for it. It's a niche thing to try to sell and a hard thing to price economically.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the most like rewarding, enriching experiences that I've had as a songwriter, which just speaks to this entire conversation, I think, is when people have partnered with me to write songs for them.
Mm-hmm.
I've written songs for people's dogs. I've mostly written songs for engagements and anniversaries, maybe some birthdays here and there. Occasionally have taken an inside joke and putting that to a song.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a really amazing way to make art extremely personal and specific. Yeah, it's a really fun, rewarding thing for me that, you know, for people I've worked with, you know, a lot of them have continued to cherish the songs that I've made for them, you know, mm-hmm. for years to come. And like, I know a couple that like listens to their song like every anniversary, or even like their kid will just sometimes ask for, to listen to it. So that's one thing I do. But the main place I point people to is friends.chasetremaine.com. It's where you can find what I call the Friends Club, a slightly unoriginal take on fan club, but it's a membership / community platform that I created similar to Patreon. It provides two kind of main things. One, it's a very cheap and affordable way for friends to support me financially in my music making and freelancing pursuits. I only charge $2 a month or $20 a year. But the other road of it is that people who are just fans, it is an access way to have an actual friendship with me that goes beyond simply parasocial or just being a listener. You know, I do regular Zoom hangouts with people in the group and have one-on-one Zoom calls with everyone who wants one. And we get to actually connect. And there's a weekly podcast that I release just within the Friends Club, and monthly songs that I release. And we have a book club, which is currently going through, as you could probably guess, Lord of the Rings right now. So a lot of really cool things and good things have come from it. But that's just on the side of me also like producing music for other artists, writing songs for people, and as I briefly mentioned earlier, editing books for independent authors. That's kind of all the current stuff. But I do, as you said, I have kind of a prolific past. I've made 3 kind of full band studio albums that are fairly polished and professional that are on all streaming services. So that's Unfall, Development and Compromise, and Accidental Days. So those 3 albums, I still stand by those songs and their quality and would recommend those to anyone. And those are streaming everywhere. But the best way to kind of hear what I'm doing nowadays and the stuff that I'm self-producing, I kind of switched from paying producers and going into real studios into self-producing as we were preparing for my first daughter to be born almost 2 years ago. Knowing that I would want to be home more and to be saving money mm-hmm. and investing more in her than in my music kind of was the fire for me to learn self-production and to really develop on that side of things. So if it looks like I'm prolific on just by looking at like Spotify or Bandcamp, there's dozens of more songs in the Friends Club for anyone who joins there.
Nice. All right. Well, I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And I'd really like to play one of your songs to close out this episode. So is there a song you think would be particularly fitting? And why don't you set that up for us?
Yeah. So I was thinking about this. And the temptation, I guess, here would be to present what I think would be the most impressive song possible. You know, there's probably a lot of people listening, maybe even everyone listening, who has not heard my music before.
Mm-hmm.
And, but ultimately, like, if you're interested, again, like, there is albums of material out on all the streaming services that's all easily accessible. So the song that I want to share is actually my brand newest song that was just written and recorded in these past few weeks. It's one of the songs that is exclusively given to my Friends Club members. So this song is called Sing For Me.
Mm.
And it is everything we've talked about.
Oh.
It's a song that I just wrote in early April, like literally brand new, as kind of the overflow of some of these things that we've been talking about and some of these things that I've been thinking about a lot of, just if all electricity was gone, if all modern technology was gone, like, would you sing songs for me?
Mm.
And so I think this is the perfect song to play for this conversation. And for anyone who might be interested in joining the Friends Club, this is an exclusive way to hear a sneak peek of kind of the style and quality of songs that you would be getting on a monthly basis there if you joined.
All right. Well, thank you, Chase. That's awesome. Thank you so much. It was great talking to you today. And I look forward to working with you continually into the future, as long as you'll as long as you'll have us.
No, I'm super happy to be part of the Renew the Arts team, and yeah, it's just fun to be on this side of the microphone, so I appreciate you having me.
Well, thank you all for listening, and we will be back next month with probably another interview. We have about 3 or 4 interviews all worked out for this new season that I'm really excited about. And we might have a couple of solo podcasts, probably will as well. And so if you're not tired of hearing my voice, you can tune in for those as well. And we will see you next time.